From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, an interview with Michael Stipe, R.E.M.'s lead singer and songwriter. We'll also hear music from R.E.M.'s new CD. Two of Orson Welles' great movies, Touch of Evil and Citizen Kane, are back in movie theaters. We'll talk with actor Simon Callow about his biography of Welles. Book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Philip Roth's new novel, I Married a Communist, and film critic John Powers reviews the new film adaptation of Toni Morrison's novel, Beloved, produced by and starring Oprah Winfrey. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The final act of the 105th Congress, a vote on an omnibus spending package, has been put off until early next week. Lawmakers say House Democrats have asked for more time to read the massive bill. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
Vermont Senator James Jeffords announced on the Senate floor this morning that the hoped-for wrap-up of the 105th Congress will have to wait. The session has already dragged on a week longer than anticipated, as negotiators for Congress and the White House battled over a slew of spending and policy disputes. Speaker Newt Gingrich yesterday predicted easy passage in both the House and Senate for the $500 billion package that includes 8 of the 13 appropriations bills. But it takes a certain amount of time to get a bill this large and this diverse into formal legislative language. And then some lawmakers will want to review it to see if the agreements they've been briefed on are actually there in black and white. The result, members say, is a vote that won't come before Monday and may have to wait until Tuesday. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, the Capitol.
One of the winners of today's Nobel Peace Prize says the award will strengthen the Irish peace process. Catholic leader John Hume is sharing the award with Protestant leader David Trimble. Trimble heads Northern Ireland's new cross-governmental parliament. Irish Prime Minister Bertie Ahern and British Prime Minister Tony Blair have both saluted the winners, saying no recipients could be more worthy of the prize. Japan's parliament ended its current session today by enacting a major recapitalization law that shores up the country's embattled banking sector. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from Tokyo.
In their final session, Japan's lawmakers labored and brought forth a long-sought framework to deal with a bruising bad debt crisis burdening the country's banks. A $508 billion revitalization plan is equivalent to about 12% of Japan's gross domestic product. The ambitious package provides $144 billion to protect depositors, $212 billion to recapitalize solvent banks, and another $152 billion to take over failed ones. The legislation breaks a political logjam that has stretched on for months while an appalled world watched. And while the deal forged with the opposition is seen as political progress, Japan's banks, which uniformly fear the stigma of public money, must now be persuaded to accept it. This is Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Tokyo.
President Clinton has left Israeli and Palestinian negotiators alone today in eastern Maryland, hoping both sides will draw closer to a peace agreement. But Secretary of State Madeleine Albright has remained behind to help guide talks. Mr. Clinton and the secretary met separately yesterday with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 94 points at 8,393. In very heavy trading, the Nasdaq is up nearly 20. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, yesterday's cut in two key interest rates by the Federal Reserve seems to be exactly the tonic that market investors need today. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
One day after the Federal Reserve rate cut and a 300-point gain on Wall Street, stocks are higher again today. The market seemingly is signaling its approval, what amounted to a preemptive strike by the Fed. The interest rate-setting body, for the first time in 4 years, instituted a rate change outside of a regularly scheduled meeting. The government also released two key economic reports today. The Labor Department reported consumer prices were unchanged in September. Industrial production, meanwhile, fell 0.3% last month. Several big companies released their quarterly earnings today. Merck & Company, the country's largest drug maker, says its third-quarter net income rose 14% to $1.37 billion. And heavy equipment maker Caterpillar says third-quarter profits were down from a year ago to $336 million. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
The United Nations says the condition of poor people around the world has gotten worse. Nearly half of all children living in southern Asia aren't fed well. 1.5 billion people living in developing countries earn less than a dollar a day. In sub-Saharan Africa, a third of the people probably will not live longer than 40 years. The UN's development program says part of the problem is lower aid giving by richer countries, and poor countries are putting forth feeble efforts to fight poverty. Nike has raised the pay of factory workers in Indonesia by about 25%. That brings their salaries to $23 per month, up from the government's mandated minimum $18. The move follows sharp criticism of the company's labor practices. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, where imaginations can run wild. Over 200 locations nationwide. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The band R.E.M. has a new CD. On this archive edition, we have an interview with its lead singer and songwriter, Michael Stipe. The band was formed in 1980, and for several years it was a critics' favorite with a devoted following among alternative rock listeners. But despite its emphasis on making non-commercial music, R.E.M. went on to become a commercial success. Last year, the band was thrown into a tailspin when its drummer, founding member Bill Berry, left. The band members say they used that as an opportunity to reinvent their sound. Let's hear a track from their new CD, Up. This is The Apologist.
Apologize for everything I was. So I'm sorry, so sorry, so sorry, so sorry. I'm so sorry, so sorry, so sorry.
Michael Stipe has been an inspiration to musicians starting their own bands. Stipe recently paid tribute to the performer who most influenced him, Patti Smith. Last spring, when I spoke with him, he had published a book of photos that he took of Smith on tour. He wrote that he first found out about Patti Smith when he was 15 and stuck in high school detention hall. I asked him to tell the whole story.
There was an article that that the writer Lisa Robinson had written about the CBGB scene in New York, which was just starting, I think, in 74, 75 was when it really kicked in with Patti and bands like Television. And I think the Talking Heads and Blondie came a little bit later. But she wrote an article comparing that scene to the music of the time, saying that the music of the time was very technicolor and very blown out and very colorful, and this was very stripped down and visceral and raw, and much more like black and white TV, like a staticky old TV. And there was a photograph of Patti Smith leaning against a wall, looking at the camera, and the picture was so so haunting and so mesmerizing. I think I immediately felt, you know, like there was something here that was worth investigating, and so I started trying to find out about this music and trying to find out about these people that were making it, and bought her first record the day it came out. And it was very epiphanal. I decided then and there that music was what I wanted to do with my life.
So at this point, did you have any sense that you could sing or that you could write songs?
Not really. I played accordion when I was in third grade. I really wanted to play organ, but they ran out of organ, so I played accordion. But I never really sang, you know, very much, and I didn't really have an idea of what I wanted to do with my life. But the punk ethic in the mid-70s, when all this stuff was going on, Patti Smith and Television are really the two bands that I look to. The ethic was kind of do-it-yourself, that anybody could do what they were doing. It didn't take a special person to do it, and I took that very literally and decided then and there at the age of 15 or 16 that I was going to be a singer.
Excuse me for being sidetracked here for a moment, but accordion, what were you playing on those accordion books? Did you have one of those beginning accordion books with the horrible songs in it?
I don't think I could read them. I mean, I don't think I could read the music. But my third grade class, Mrs. Swindle was our teacher, had a band, and we would play various songs of the day. I think the Green, Green Grass of Home and stuff like that. And me and my best friend, Mike Rooney, played accordion. And at one point we asked Mrs. Swindle if we could yell things out because we weren't allowed to sing. We had to play the accordion. I guess that took greater concentration than singing. But we asked if we could yell things out like, "Go, Daddy-O." And so the two of us would stand on the side, and in the middle of the Green, Green Grass of Home, we'd be like, "Yeah, man, yeah, go, Daddy-O."
Oh, that's really great.
That right. was my auspicious musical beginnings. But I just decided, I felt like I had discovered something that I felt very much a part of at that pretty young age. And I stuck to it.
In your book of photos of Patti Smith, you say that when you were 15 and you discovered her, you were a dork nerd. What qualified you for dork nerddom?
Well, I think I'm still kind of a geek, you know. And most of my really good friends are too. It's like there's that old adage that the world is divided into two types of people: those that snore and those that admit. Those that admit that they snore. Is that how it goes?
I don't know it.
I can't remember. Anyway, I think we're all pretty geeky. You know, we're a pretty geeky species, and I'm just smart enough to admit it, I guess. But I didn't. You know, I think in high school I felt very much an outsider, and I didn't really feel like I fit in anywhere. And this music gave me a place where I felt like I fit in.
Back in 1992, you told Rolling Stone magazine that no one has picked up on how much you've lifted from Patti Smith as a performer. What do you feel like you lifted from her as a performer?
Oh, well, just there were things about her vocal style that I really admired, and there was a certain freedom and looseness to almost a scatting quality that she has, and a fearlessness. I mean, more than anything, I think the fearlessness. That's not to say that throughout R.E.M.'s career I've really embodied that. I'm not sure that I have, but I think in moments here and there, we've produced stuff that has that same energy to it. Some of my favorite songs are the ones that really just seem like I didn't even know what happened. Suddenly there was a song and there were words, and somewhere in some very obtuse way they made sense.
Well, I think it's time to listen to some more of your music, and I thought we'd start pretty close to the beginning and hear something from the first EP that R.E.M. released called Chronic Town. I think it was recorded in 81 and released in 82. And the song I thought we could hear from it is Wolves Lower. Would you say something about the song, about writing it, or about this moment in your life when it was recorded?
I don't really remember much about that. I was kind of nervous to be in the recording studio, and I hadn't really learned how to write words, so I'm not sure how many actual real words there are in the song, but it's got a nice vibe.
Well, let's hear it.
Okay.
Suspicion yourself, suspicion yourself, don't get caught. Suspicion yourself, suspicion yourself, let others out.
R.E.M., my guest, is singer Michael Stipe, singer and songwriter. So let's get back to when you were a teenager, when you just started singing. You were telling us that you didn't really think seriously about music till you were 15 and discovered Patti Smith. So when you started thinking that you were serious about music, what happened next? Did you start singing more?
Well, when I was 17, I guess, I answered an ad and joined a band that was, I guess, kind of like a punk rock cover band, pretty much. And we had a real good time. We never really played out in public very much. It was mostly just kind of a garage band. And then when I moved to Athens at the age of 18, I really, really wanted to find somebody that I could work with. And
this is Athens, Georgia that you met?
Athens, Georgia, yeah. And that's when I met Peter Buck, and he was very resistant to the idea of forming a band because he felt like people in bands were assholes, and he didn't want to be that. And he also didn't feel like he was a very good guitar player, which at the time he wasn't. But I didn't know how to sing and had never written a song in my life. So after months of urging, he finally caved in, and we started R.E.M.
My guest is Michael Stipe of R.E.M. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Michael Stipe, recorded last spring. In some of R.E.M.'s earlier recordings, his voice was mixed behind the music. When I asked him why his voice wasn't more up front, he said it had to do with his own insecurity.
You know, at the time, in the early 80s, everyone was mixing the drums louder than the vocal, and I just thought that was really embarrassing. We didn't want to be a disco band, and I was somewhat reacting to the music of the day, but I was also just kind of embarrassed because I'd never really, you know, the thought process of being a singer, being in a band, putting out a record, and then it's like, oh, whoops, well, I've got to write words because people expect words, and then, oh, well, the words should make sense. And, I mean, if you listen to our records starting with Wolves Lower, which we just heard, and progressing, the first really three or four records, including Chronic Town, you're basically watching four guys learn how to write songs. And you're watching me learn how to write a lyric, and I find that kind of fascinating. You know, those records mean a whole lot to a lot of people. Sometimes they're a little hard for me to listen to, but I do appreciate them for what they are.
Right. I'm wondering if you were influenced by any soul singers too.
I think I must have been, but I can't think of anybody right on. Growing up as a child, my parents were not huge music fans. It was like a lot of Gershwin and Mancini and the 1812 Overture with real cannons and what else?
Well, your father's in the military.
The Sound of Music, yeah.
But
we lived in Texas for a stint, and there was country radio, and that was bubblegum, when bubblegum pop radio was really big. And so that was certainly an influence. I didn't really have an older brother or sister that turned me on to the Beatles and turned me on to the Who and turned me on to all the music of the 60s. And so, you know, I kind of discovered stuff via radio as a child. And then really up until I found that magazine article and heard Horses, I was just kind of coasting along. I mean, I think before that, the only one musical artist that I thought was really interesting was Elton John. When Benny and the Jets came out, I thought that was one of the most amazing, and I still do it. For me, Benny and the Jets and Rock On by David Essex are two of the most amazing, they'd be in my top 10 of best pop songs ever.
Now, I know because your father was in military, you moved around a lot as a kid, mm-hmm. as he got transferred to different military bases. What impact did it have on you to always be the new kid in the neighborhood?
Well, the positive aspects are that my family and I are very close, and when you're forced to make new friends fairly regularly, it kind of brings you together as a unit. I hate that word. Well, anyway, we were a great loving family and very close, and we still are, and that's about the greatest gift that could ever be given to me, is to have my two sisters, my mom and dad, be very supportive and and to unconditionally, you know, love me the way that they have all along. And, of course, that's returned.
When you started performing, what were your like rock values? You know, the things that you really loved about rock, the things that you never wanted to become that you'd seen other bands become?
My band always, I feel like a kind of like a broken record because I say this so much, but it's really the truth. We always kind of operated by process of negation. We knew everything that we didn't want to be, and the things that were left were our options. And we were fortunate enough to be a small band that had to work very, very hard to get to the place that we finally got to. And we also had no expectations, no goals. So every time that we had a success, it was kind of a surprise, and we were all kind of like thrown back by it. And it kind of took us to the top of the heap, which was a pretty cool place to be.
What didn't you want to be?
I didn't want to buy my own myth. I didn't want to be a cliche. I didn't want to be typical or mediocre.
Let me play another REM track, and I think I'll choose one of your most famous recordings, your big hit, Losing My Religion. Is there a story behind this song?
Yeah. I was embarrassed about it at the time, but I finally fessed up to being a huge fan of the song Every Breath You Take by The Police. And I thought that that song was like really kind of an intense, it was a beautiful pop song, and it was very lovely, and but you could take it more than one way. It seemed very kind of creepy and obsessive on one hand, and very kind of like intense and loving on the other hand. And I wanted to write a song that was like that. So I wrote Losing My Religion.
Okay, well, this is it. That's REM. My guest is lead singer and songwriter Michael Stipe. You know, I think a lot of people have a personal story to tell about that song, particularly about the lines, "Oh no, I've said too much, I haven't said enough." I think a lot of people have stories about times when they really weren't sure about whether they've said too much or said enough. Do you have a story that matches with those lines?
Well, no, I didn't really take it from any real life situation. I just think it was more about fear of rejection, you know, and when you're like really crazy about somebody and you want to tell them, but you're trying to give them hints, and then they're maybe not getting it, or they're saying something back to you and you're taking it the wrong way. And that's really, it's that kind of weird, uneasy area is what that song kind of covers.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's very successful. I really like the song a lot.
Oh, me too. I'm glad you still like it. A lot of people get tired of their own hits. Then they get angry with you if you play them.
Yeah, no, it's a good song.
And you still play it in performances?
We try to. yeah, we do.
How do you think fame has affected the band? You know, you're talking about all the values you didn't want to have, and I think there are some values that become almost difficult to avoid. Yeah. Once the spotlight hits.
Yeah. the guys have always been really supportive of me being the front person, and the fact that I would get more attention and I would be the one that photographers wanted to take pictures of or wanted to push to the front of the picture. And that I'm the one that gets recognized in restaurants or, you know, when we walk down the street or whatever. They've always been really, really supportive. I know that Bill, before he quit the band, our drummer, always said that he wouldn't trade places with me for anything in the world, and sometimes really felt sorry for me because he would be able to say, you know, he'd be able to say, call a restaurant and say, I'm in REM, or call, you know, the baseball people and say, I'd like tickets, I'm in REM, and they would give them to him where he could go anonymously into that restaurant or into the baseball place. I maybe couldn't, and especially after Losing My Religion, because that was really, that was a song that really made us international, you know, pop stars, if you will. And at that point, you know, I really had to kind of come to terms with that because I was being recognized just about everywhere that I went. And that can kind of throw you, you know.
Well, the shame.
But I had had whatever, 13 years of being in a band and being a star in my own head to kind of build up to that. So it wasn't that horrible.
Right. I'm sure, you know, like shaving your head also helped people recognize you.
Yeah, it was easier when I could grow my hair different lengths, but my hair started to fall out, so I shaved it off.
Right. I think the word that's most often used to describe you is the word enigmatic.
I hate that word.
Yeah, what do you think of that?
I think it's stupid. I mean, I hate that word. That word followed me for years and years and years. And, you know, I did say early on, and I did feel, and I still do, that, you know, an air of mystery around certainly a public figure, but also just in life, is not altogether a bad thing. That you don't ever want to really give everything away. And at whatever point you do, you know, it might be too much.
Michael Stipe recorded last spring after the publication of his book of photos of Patti Smith. REM has a new CD called Up. Here's another track from it called Day Sleeper. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Receiving department, 3 a.m. Staff cuts have socked up the overage. Directives are posted, no callbacks, complaints. Everywhere is calm. Hong Kong is present, Taipei wakes up. Talk of circadian rhythm, I see today. Gray, my night is colored. Had a great day, sleeper.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. Columbia Records, presenting the new self-titled album from John Mellencamp featuring Your Life Is Now, available in stores. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Two Orson Welles films are back in movie theaters, Touch of Evil and Citizen Kane. Coming up, actor Simon Callow discusses his biography of Welles. Also, reviews of Philip Roth's new novel, I Married a Communist, and the film Beloved, starring Oprah Winfrey.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Philip Roth's new novel is called I Married a Communist. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says her review should be called I Read a Masterwork.
Last Wednesday night, on the eve of the announcement of the Nobel Prize for Literature, I got a phone message from a New York radio station asking if they could call at 7 the next morning to get my hot-off-the-press critical assessment of the winner's literary merits. I didn't return the call, wisely, as it turns out. I'm not as well-versed in Portuguese magical realist novels as perhaps I should be. In fact, when I first heard the phone message, I turned to a friend and clairvoyantly said, "The Nobel Prize will probably go to somebody I've never heard of. If they ever gave it to Philip Roth, then maybe I'd have a few words to say." Here, I'll take the opportunity to make another prophetic pronouncement. The Nobel Prize will never go to Philip Roth, though it should. He's too coarse, too mean, too comical, too self-referential, too political, too Jewish, or as his detractors have charged, too self-hatingly Jewish to ever ascend to the pantheon of Nobel laureates. I hope history proves me wrong, but Roth isn't helping his candidacy any with his latest reckless performance called I Married a Communist. There's the novel's outlandish 1950s-type drive-in movie title. It's arrogant resurrection of Roth's fictional alter ego, Nathan Zuckerman, as its framing narrator. It's touchy political subject, the 1950s witch hunts. It's nasty, pee-in-your-pants funny, insider swipes at Roth's ex-wife, Claire Bloom, and about 100 other crimes against literary decorum, proportion, and tolerance. I Married a Communist is great, but it's great in Roth's signature way. It's too much. He's always going to irritate too many of the right people. And it's too talky. That's at least one critic's complaint about I Married a Communist. Roth, too talky. That's like saying Shakespeare is too iambic pentameter. Talk. Glorious, informed, vivacious, wide-ranging talk is the structural and substantive essence of Roth's novels. Unlike most people I meet in real life, I wish his characters would never shut up. I Married a Communist is composed as a long, impassioned reminiscence about betrayals, personal and political, during the McCarthy era. The novel finds Nathan Zuckerman living a recluse's life in western New England. I came here because I don't want a story any longer. I've had my story, Nathan tells us. But one day, he runs into a story from his past in the person of Murray Ringgold, his beloved high school English teacher, who at 90 is enrolled at an elder hostel at a nearby college. Murray visits Nathan's cabin every night for 6 nights. And fueled by martinis, Murray the Ancient Mariner passes on the true tale of his brother Ira, who also deeply influenced Nathan when he was a teenager in Newark during the 1950s. Ira was a big shot, a charismatic radio actor known by the stage name Iron Rin. We learn that Ira's early career as an agitprop actor was fostered by the Communist Party, of which he was a card-carrying member. At the height of his fame in the late 1940s, Ira married the celebrated actress Eve Frame, a.k.a. Hava Fromkin, a porcelain doll dead ringer for the former Mrs. Philip Roth. The marriage was doomed from the start by the presence of Eve's sadistic, harp-playing adult daughter. Ira eventually strayed, and to get even, Eve conspired with two red-baiting gossip columnists to publish a tell-all book about her marriage called I Married a Communist. Mirrors within mirrors, that's what Roth's fiction is made out of. But there's always a larger purpose than self-display to his reflections. Here, he engages big think issues like the role of art in society and the inevitable treasons built into the parent-child relationship. Along the way, he sketches indelible images of the Italian ward in Newark in the 1920s, and in the audacious final paragraphs of the novel, even makes us see anew the transcendent symbolism of stars in the night sky. Then there are those characters and their talk. Even the walk-ons have unforgettable lines. In recognition of the great debt of pleasure I owe him, I'd like to cede the floor to Nathan's teacher, Murray, the champion talker. Here's a fraction of Murray's very relevant to today riff on how politics changed during the 1950s. I think of the McCarthy era as inaugurating the post-war triumph of gossip as the unifying credo of the world's oldest democratic republic. In gossip we trust. Gossip as gospel, the national faith. McCarthyism as the beginning not just of serious politics, but of serious everything as entertainment to amuse the mass audience. McCarthyism as the first post-war flowering of the American unthinking that is now everywhere. Keep the offensive insights coming, Philip Roth. We need them more than you need the Nobel Prize.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Philip Roth's new novel, I Married a Communist. Coming up, a talk with actor Simon Callow about Orson Welles. Two Welles movies are back in theaters. This is Fresh Air. Two great movies, which Orson Welles directed and starred in, Touch of Evil and Citizen Kane, have been re-released and are playing theatrically in selected cities. Touch of Evil has been re-edited and remixed to closer approximate the vision Welles had before the studio did the final edit. Citizen Kane is widely considered among the best films ever made. Welles plays newspaper publisher Charles Foster Kane. Here's a scene from early in Citizen Kane, where Kane is arguing with his banker, who's angry about an article Kane's paper just published because it indicts the public transit company which the banker and Welles own.
Charles, I think I should remind you of a fact that you seem to have forgotten.
Yes,
that you are yourself one of the largest individual stockholders in the public transit company.
The trouble is you don't realize you're talking to two people. As Charles Foster Kane, who owns 82,364 shares of public transit preferred, you see, I do have a general idea of my holdings. I sympathize with you. Charles Foster Kane is a scoundrel. His paper should be run out of town. A committee should be formed to boycott him. You may, if you can form such a committee, put me down for a contribution of $1,000.
My time's...
On the other hand, I am the publisher of the Enquirer. As such, it's my duty, and I'll let you in on a little secret. It's also my pleasure to see to it that decent, hardworking people in this community aren't robbed blind by a pack of money-mad pirates just because they haven't anybody to look after their interests. I'll let you in on another little secret, Mr. Thatcher. I think I'm the man to do it, you see. I have money and property. If I don't look after the interests of the underprivileged, maybe somebody else will.
On this archive edition, we have an interview about Orson Welles with Simon Callow, recorded in 1996, after the publication of the first volume of Callow's biography of Welles. It concludes with the completion of Citizen Kane. Simon Callow is an actor who also wrote an acclaimed book about Charles Laughton. Callow is best known to Americans through his roles as the villain in Ace Ventura, When Nature Calls, the character who is buried in Four Weddings and a Funeral, and the Reverend in A Room with a View. Callow writes that Welles worked hard as a director, but never really pushed himself hard as an actor. Welles simply accepted that he had the temperament and physique to be a leading actor.
He knew that he had certain great natural endowments, a voice the like of which no other actor has had this century, I would say, of commanding physique. You know, he was 6'2" and tremendously broadly built, a very, very powerful, imposing man. And he was very, very intelligent. And he more or less brought these three gifts to his performances. But there was no question of him searching within himself for the character. And there was not terribly much ambition in terms of the actual physical gesture of the character. He had a view that acting essentially consisted of suppressing certain elements of yourself. And in addition, putting on things like noses and various, in fact, large quantities of makeup. But The next stage of that, which is an approach favoured by many actors, which is generally to then give in to the thing that you've created. You put on your false nose, you put on your makeup, you look in the mirror, you see somebody else looking back at you, and you start to become that other person. That last bit was the bit Wells resisted. He didn't want that. He wanted to be in control all the time, so that he was on top of the character, as it were, presenting the character to the audience at one remove.
Do you think because his personality was so outsized, he didn't want to make it subservient to the character's personality?
I think that's right. And I think he also had developed this, as you say, outsized personality, and was the last thing he wanted to do was to investigate alternative possibilities of who or what he might have been. This was it. This was the Orson Welles that he wanted to be, and he stuck with it.
You know, I'm a big fan of your earlier biography of Charles Laughton. And as I was telling you before we recorded the interview, a quote of Laughton's that I quite like is Laughton saying, people don't know what they're like, but I think I can show them, which I think beautifully sums up acting at its best. When I mentioned this, my admiration for this quote to you, you said this is something that Orson Welles would never say.
Yes, absolutely.
Why not?
He didn't think of acting or indeed the theatre as a mirror of human life in the way that Laughton obviously did, and to some extent that Brecht, to whom Laughton made the remark, did. Instead, Wells, I believe, saw it as the telling of big fables, which to some extent gave a model of human life. But in no sense, I believe, did he think that it was a personal statement or a personal revelation. Whereas Laughton absolutely fed off his own inner life to an extraordinary degree, to an almost morbid degree, but to a degree that meant that his finest performances are piercingly human and disturbing in a way that nothing, I think, that Welles as an actor ever did. This is not that, you must understand, to denounce Welles as an actor. He had many remarkable qualities and was a very exhilarating performer on many occasions. But what Laughton was trying to do, I suspect, was more creative than what Welles was attempting, more creative and more courageous, and in the end cost him more, a price that Welles wasn't prepared to pay or didn't think worth paying.
Now, Welles didn't push himself hard as an actor, but he sure seemed to push the actors who he was directing really hard, particularly in Citizen Kane, where he did take after take after take until he felt that it was exactly what he wanted.
Absolutely. When I say he didn't push himself very hard, I mean, he was, frankly, a rather lazy actor. That's in a nutshell, what Welles was. But he did push himself quite far physically sometimes, and he certainly pushed his actors very far physically. If there was a sequence that involved coordinated action, then Welles would work it and work it and work it. But Welles was by no means of the persuasion of, shall we say, Stanislavski or Harold Clurman or even a Guthrie McClintock. He didn't actually require the actors to delve into themselves. He didn't he wasn't challenging the truth, as it were. What he was challenging was the physical execution.
Well, he even transformed himself for Citizen Kane. What did he do to make himself the handsome young man that he thought Kane needed to be for the performance?
Yes. Welles was, even as a young man, in a constant struggle with his waistline. And for the early Kane, he, first of all, was taking quite a lot of dietary tablets, which were mostly amphetamines, and he was wearing a fierce corset, and his whole face was pulled back with the use of fish glue. He gave himself, as it were, a face lift with makeup. Maurice Seideman, his makeup artist, devised this incredible sort of cage to pull back, rather in the manner of the later Marlene Dietrich, to pull the whole of the muscular face back. And indeed, he looks pretty dazzling as a result of it. But he was very funny about it in later life. Norman Mailer had said of him that he was, at that age, the most beautiful young man who had ever lived. And Welles very self-mockingly said, but it took 5 hours to get it that way.
Right.
Do you mind talking about Citizen Kane? Because I know you started off to write about the theater life of Orson Welles, not his film life.
Oh, I'm delighted. Nothing pleases me more. After all, the book is called The Road to Xanadu, and Xanadu is where Citizen Kane exists. So the whole point, really, of my once I'd changed my idea of writing a biography was just to show how all that early life and all that theatre fed into his work on the screen. And it's fascinating that the cinematographer that he worked with, Greg Toland, favoured long takes and wasn't keen on a fussy cutting technique where you keep cutting away to people.
Well, let me back up a second here. When Orson Welles made Citizen Kane, it was his first movie. He'd just come to Hollywood. He hadn't acted on screen before. He certainly hadn't directed before. And so he had to surround himself with talented people. And one of the people who he worked with was Greg Toland, the cinematographer, who had done what other films? What, Wuthering Heights, Grapes of Wrath?
And most importantly, a film called The Long Voyage Home for John Ford, which is where he began the experiment that he continued with Kane, experimenting with deep focus photography, using ceilings and all of that stuff.
Yeah, explain a little more what this approach to deep focus was and why it was unusual at that time.
Well, the prevailing cinematographic language was one of in which there was an attempt to distill a kind of pleasing, realistic picture. The idea was to make it look like life. And what Toland favoured was a much more dramatic conception, much more visually charged. So as you could, for example, have a scene in which people were a long way apart from each other, but both was in focus. Whereas normally the sort of lenses and the sort of lighting that was favoured by the mainstream cinematography was to favour the close-up and the foreground figure. So as a background figure would be in soft focus. What it does is to make the dynamic impact of each frame hugely greater. It's quite a shock. Every frame of Citizen Kane punches you between the eyes. That's what Toland thought cinematography should be. Curious enough, he thought that was more realistic than the other approach to cinema. But in fact, we now feel that it's very intensified and indeed somewhat expressionistic, which is really where the techniques evolved in the German cinema of the 20s and 30s and early 30s.
Did Toland's cinematography work well with Welles' experience as a man of the theatre?
Oh, tremendously, because Welles was, you might say, for the most part, he was a sort of expressionist theatre director, and he favoured the extreme contrasts in lighting that is also characteristic of the expressionist cinema, and he used shadows a great deal, which is another very, very common feature of that kind of shooting. And what he strove for in the theatre was exactly what Toland strove for in film, which was maximum expressive impact. So as you were absolutely electrified by the physical production of a Welles show.
You describe Welles as being almost ruthless at rehearsals because he'd rehearse his actor so much and then have him do take after take until he felt the scene was perfect.
Yeah.
What can you tell us about what the rehearsals were like? And what interests you about them as an actor yourself?
You mean the rehearsals for Kane?
For Kane.
Well, first of all, he did a lot of rehearsal, which is quite an unusual thing in film. As unusual then as still unusual. He sort of stole time out of the studio schedules by pretending that they were just read-throughs. They were really very clearly and vividly planned and rehearsed before they got in front of the camera. As I said, Toland's cinematography played very well into Welles's theatrical experience because he wasn't interested. One of the first things you have to decide as a director is how you're going to dispose the shots in the scene. How are you going to break it down? So, Is the camera going to be on me during my speech and then cut to somebody else? Will we have a wide shot? Will we have a close-up? All that grammar of film is very hard to master. Fortunately, Toland, as I said, favoured rather long takes in which the camera followed the actors. So Wells could stage the thing however he liked, more or less as he would do on a stage in the theatre. And then Toland devised the camera movement, which would follow them round. So there are wonderful sequences, like the party at the Enquirer, in which the camera, it never stops moving and follows everyone. It's a long time before you actually get a cut to anything. And so that terrible anxiety, I speak from experience, since I've directed a movie, and one of the hardest things for me to really come to terms with was the question of the breakdown of the shots. But Wells didn't really have that problem. And indeed, it made it a great deal easier for editing, too, because by and large, the editing was sort of done in the camera. The Robert Wise, who edited it, didn't really have all that much to do. It had all been shot in the camera. Instead of having acres and acres of footage in which you decide, shall I cut away to this or cut away to that? On the contrary, in Kane, the scenes really hold from beginning to end.
Simon Callow, recorded in 1996 after the publication of the first volume of his biography of Orson Welles. Welles' films Touch of Evil and Citizen Kane are back in theaters in selected cities and will be opening in more cities in the next few weeks. Coming up, a review of Oprah Winfrey's new movie Beloved. This is Fresh Air. Our film critic John Powers has a review of the new film adaptation of Toni Morrison's 1987 Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, Beloved. The movie stars Oprah Winfrey, who also produced it.
It's an enduring cliché that Hollywood treats literature with vulgar disrespect. Yet the truth is often exactly the opposite. Our filmmakers approach literary classics with such hushed reverence that they often smother the movie with their fidelity. That's what happens in Beloved, a gothic tale about the scars of slavery and the power to move beyond them. Set in 1873 Ohio, the movie stars Oprah Winfrey as Setha, a strong-willed, heavy-spirited ex-slave who 18 years earlier escaped the Sweet Home plantation, whose owners violated her and whipped her so badly that her back still shows the tracery. Now Setha lives in a small, dingy, haunted house with her daughter Denver. One day she gets a surprise visit from the amiable Paul D., that's Danny Glover, a long-lost friend who is also a slave at Sweet Home. Although Paul D. finds Setha's house creepy, they set about making a home, until their life is suddenly invaded by an otherworldly young woman who croaks and simpers and has the herky-jerk motions of a puppet. This mysterious creature is named Beloved. She's played by Tandy Newton. And Setha believes her to be one of her dead children come back to life. Beloved's presence sets off a wild chain of events that eventually reveals the full horror of Setha's past, including a crime she herself committed in the name of love. This dark secret is so dreadful that even the good-hearted Paul D. is driven to confront Setha about it.
Love is too thick, Setha.
Love is or it isn't, Paul D. Thin love ain't no love at all. I stopped him. I put my babies where they'd be safe.
Didn't work, though, did it? Your boy's gone. You don't know where. One girl's dead. The other can't get further than the yard. How did it work?
They ain't at Sweet Home. School teacher ain't got 'em.
Maybe there's worse.
It ain't my job to know what's worse, Paul D. It's my job to know what it is and to keep my children away from it. Because I'd rather know they had peace in heaven than live in a hell here on earth. So help me, Jesus.
What you did was wrong, Setha.
I should have gone back there, took my babies, back to Sweet Home.
Yeah, there could have been a way, some other way.
What way, Paul D?
You got 2 feet, Setha, not four.
It's an act of courage to try to adapt Toni Morrison's original novel, and director Jonathan Demme remains resolutely faithful to the book's often obscure style. The magical realist flourishes, the constant skipping between time periods, and the long, slow, moody buildup to the story's lacerating climax. What dances across the page can often lie dead on the screen, and for its opening 90 minutes, the movie's nearly 3 hours long, Beloved is punishing to watch. The colors are desaturated, the supernatural intrusions are badly done, the dramatic scenes are flat and uninvolving. It's as if Demme doesn't want to sully his story with anything that the audience might find pleasurable. Here is serious filmmaking with a vengeance, and though it's far more artistically audacious than Demme's last film, Philadelphia, it suffers from a similar self-importance. Every frame says, "This is good for you." It's less good for the actors, whose performances are shockingly uneven. While Glover is solid as Paul D, Tandy Newton's Beloved is wincingly misguided. Rather than making us feel Beloved's witchy power, her cooing, burbling, cutesy turn verges on parody. She seems to belong in a different movie than little-known Kimberly Elise, who gives the film's strongest, loveliest performance as Setha's daughter Denver. She's the character who grows the most, and in the final hour, which rises to moments of genuine emotional force, we realize that the movie is actually about Denver's liberation from the haunted house, her mother's thick love, and the psychic wounds of slavery that Setha carries as her true stigmata. Of course, everything revolves around the towering figure of Setha, who we see doing everything, working, making love, peeing, going mad, committing murder, and guttering like a spent candle. It's a great seething role for Oprah, who hits every emotion so smack on the nose that I expect to see her waving an Oscar next March. Yet as I watched her performance, my mind kept drifting from the fictional Setha to the real-life Oprah, one of our country's genuinely amazing creations. Born poor and black, she has a gift for showing empathy so profound that it seems to transcend race. It has taken her to the point where she is powerful enough to make her own wildly contradictory fantasies come true. In the very month that she can be found staring glamorously from the cover of Vogue, she's also starring as a woman brutalized by slavery. In the abyss separating these two Oprahs lies an amazing story, a truly American story. And I hope you won't think me facetious when I say that I find this story far more fascinating than anything in the honorable but disappointing Beloved.
Joan Powers is Fresh Air's film critic. Today's archive edition was produced by Kathy Wolf. Chris Fraley is our engineer. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Little Brown & Company, publisher of the Breast Cancer Prevention Diet, the powerful foods, supplements, and drugs that can save your life by Dr. Bob Arnott in bookstores, and Princeton University Press, publishers of The Shape of the River by William G. Bowen and Derek Buck, an examination of race-sensitive college admissions policies and their long-term consequences, in bookstores or on the web, pup.princeton.edu. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Ray Charles. There's a new box set of his complete country and western recordings from 1959 to 86. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.